Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest warnings by a senior Israeli intelligence official that the country's leaders, Netanyahu and Barak, are intent on a war with Iran. The former head of Shin Bet stated publicly that, "I do not believe in a leadership that makes decisions based on messianic feelings. I have seen them up close. They are not messiahs, these two. And they are not the people I personally trust to lead Israel into such an event." Former CIA officer Robert Baer joins us to discuss this latest broadside from Israel's alarmed intelligence and military leaders. Then we'll look into the growing dissent in China with the escape of a prominent dissident now believed to be holed up in the U.S. embassy. China expert Perry Link joins us. He edited the Tiananmen papers that were leaked by a high-level Chinese official and led to Perry Link being blacklisted by the Chinese government. We will discuss this very public challenge to China's police state on the eve of Secretary Clinton's arrival for talks with the Chinese leadership. Then finally, we will speak with Robert Draper, the author of a news-making new book about the current House of Representatives who are held at a record low level of disrepute. Do Not Ask What Good We Do. Among the revelations in the book is a meeting that took place with Eric Cantor and other Republican leaders on the day of President Obama's inauguration, where the participants plotted to destroy the newly sworn-in presidency. And just before we begin, there's a couple of corrections I need to make. One is in regard to the Trayvon Martin story. I mentioned that Trayvon Martin's body was held for 3 days by the police in Sanford. That's true. However, apparently the parents were informed after one whole day of anguish. The next day they were allowed to come to the police station and see the body. The body, of course, was held for 3 days and drug tested, which was not what happened to George Zimmerman. So still pretty outrageous. But the other story that needs real correcting, that was last Thursday's story. Amira Woods, from the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, stated in the interview that the war criminal that was just charged by the International Criminal Court, Charles Taylor, was sprung from a U.S. prison by the CIA and was a CIA asset. However, a front-page story in the Boston Globe was printed as a front-page retraction to this story. And just reading from the retraction by the Boston Globe, the source of this connection between Taylor and the CIA, the Globe says that on a front-page story on January the 17th drew unsupported conclusions and significantly overstepped available evidence when it described former Liberian President Charles Taylor as having worked with U.S. spy agencies as a sought-after source. The story, based on a response by the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency to a long-pending records request by the Globe, described the agency's response as having confirmed its agents and CIA agents worked with Taylor beginning in the 1980s. But the agency offered no such confirmation. There has long been speculation that Taylor had such a role, speculation fueled in part by Taylor's own suggestion in trial testimony that his 1985 escape from prison in Plymouth, Massachusetts, may have been facilitated by CIA operatives. But Taylor, now standing trial before the UN Special Court on charges of rape, murder, and other offenses, denies he was ever a source for or worked for U.S. intelligence. The Globe had no adequate basis for asserting otherwise, and the story should not have run in this form. So that's the retraction, and so I apologize but at the time I was skeptical of what Amira Woods was saying, because after all, Charles Taylor did end up working with Gaddafi in a arms for diamonds smuggling racket, along with the butchering of 300,000 Sierra Leoneans and Liberians. Joining us now is Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife, True Life Spy Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Great to be back.
And just to, before we get into the Israel and Syria, do you have any comments on the Charles Taylor story, since you used to work for the CIA?
Well, yeah, it's silly. You know, you've got to understand that the United States, when it violates American law or international law, is authorized to do so by the Department of Justice and the White House. We saw that with the torture, the waterboarding. That was completely cleared by the Department of Justice, the drone attacks, and I could go on and on. You know the story. It is never, I've never seen the CIA, you know, with the exception, I suppose, in the 60s or so, you know, breaking American law by breaking somebody out of prison. It's just not the CIA, I know. And I think Taylor is using gray mail to get him out of this trial. And it's a typical defense for people. You know, fallback of the CIA told me to do it. And I think the court, The Hague, knew much better than that. And in addition, he was never an asset. The CIA is almost obligated to keep in touch with everybody in the world. You know, from the mafia to warlords anywhere, simply to see what sort of intelligence they can acquire from these people, from the dark side, if you like. And that's what they do. They did it in Africa. Sometimes it pays off, but, you know, the thing that always happens is it gets blamed for these people's actions. And it's actually made it very gun-shy that, you know, it's as the years go by, it stops meeting people like Charles Taylor, no matter what they have to say. You know, and I'll leave it up to the listeners whether we're better off or not.
Well, let's turn to Israel, because you and I had a discussion over a year ago, shortly after the former head of Mossad, Meir Dagan, made some statements of alarm that Netanyahu was bent on attacking Iran, and which Meir Dagan thought would be catastrophic. And that report went all viral over the Middle East on Al Jazeera, other Arab, and a lot of Israeli coverage as well in Haaretz and Ynet and in the broader Israeli media. You got a lot of criticism for it at the time.
I call it incoming shelling myself, but it's me.
I know, but I mean, it's everything that we said has been verified in spades now. And now, just a few days ago, the former head of Shin Bet, the country's equivalent of the FBI, went public and stated that, "I do not believe in a leadership that makes decisions based on messianic feelings. I have seen them up close," referring to Netanyahu and Barak. "They are not messiahs, these two, and they are not the people I personally trust to lead Israel into such an event," meaning a war against Iran. That's pretty extraordinary, don't you think?
Oh, I find it completely alarming. You know, let me state this. Netanyahu would not be using senior intelligence officials, even if they are retired, to send, you know, warnings to Iran, either do this or we're going to attack. It's just Israeli politics doesn't work that way.
So in other words, it's not a giant bluff. Is that what you're saying?
No, it can't be. It's just, it's not plausible. It undermines the authority of the prime minister. It's damaging to him. And he's not going to use people like this to undermine his credibility by calling messianic and sending warnings to Iran. It's just not plausible. The same thing wouldn't happen in the United States. So what concerns me is the American military, President Obama, a lot of the Israeli military have said that it is unwise to attack Iran at this point, bomb it, either limited or a wider conflict. The blowback would be incredible through the Gulf, in Lebanon, in Syria, even in Egypt. So for somebody like this to come out, and somebody who's a very wise voice, you know, Shin Bet is a very serious organization. This is it's not that politicized. To come out and say this, you know, a couple months ago I said, listen, attack's off the table. It's finished. But now I'm beginning to wonder that the Bibi has, you know, is saying, listen, the world doesn't understand Iran, and I have a historical role to stop it from threatening Israel, and I'm going to go ahead and bomb. And he's got the authority with a couple political parties, the conservatives, to put together an attack on Iran. And I think he just would ignore the United States and ignore this president.
Well, I mentioned when we spoke over a year ago about Admar Dagan, the former head of Mossad, and now we have Shin Bet. But we also had just very recently Lieutenant General Benny Gantz, the equivalent of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, saying that he thought that the Iranian leadership weren't pursuing a nuclear weapon at this point. And then you have last month, Shaul Mufaz, the former military chief and defense minister, who was born in Iran, as a matter of fact, saying that Netanyahu has a ghetto mentality. Dan Halutz, who led the military from 2005 to 2007, criticized Netanyahu last month for invoking Holocaust imagery and for his military bellicosity, saying, "We are not the kings of the world. We should remember who we are." So there's a whole list of people speaking up. If this were happening in the United States, this would be headline news everywhere. This people of this caliber, of this seniority, in concert criticizing a sitting government.
Well, I think we're missing the message here in the United States. You know, Americans are just fed up with wars in the Middle East. You know, you bring up the Middle East for most people, and their eyes glaze over. They say, "Oh, come on, another war." It's just not reasonable, you know, and I think we're just sort of, you know, distracted by the economy. We're distracted by a lot of other issues, but for Israel, for these generals to come out, this is very, very serious, and I don't think people are going to pay attention unless there's an attack, and I right now find it so improbable that we would be even coming close to going into another war in the Middle East, that I find it difficult to believe. But every time, you know, I've tucked it away in my consciousness, it always seems to come back. You know, so it's maybe better than 50%.
Well, Yuval,
this is speculation, by the way, Ian.
Right, I understand. But the Shin Bet leader, or former leader, just recently retired, Yuval Diskin, also went on to attack the Netanyahu government for not actively pursuing peace with the Palestinians. It seems to me that that's just a rather flagrant strategy on Netanyahu's part. As long as he's talking about Iran, he's not talking about the Palestinians, right?
He's distracted Washington, too, because Washington right now doesn't have time to deal with the Palestinians. You know, we have to worry about Afghanistan, getting out, you know, and getting out in the best way we can. So to bring up the Palestinian issue, we can only take two crises in the Middle East at once, as you know. And the Palestinian one is not something this White House can take on. It would just get creamed in the Republican House and Senate. You know, it just and go on and on. It's not something to bring up. So I think, you know, Netanyahu is gauging American politics every single day, and to see what he can get away with. But if he's a believer at the same time, he will go. And I don't think most Israelis want an attack on Iran either, because they know that Hezbollah would cover Israel in rockets.
Sure. Well, 80%. In a recent poll, 81% of Israelis oppose a solo attack on Iran, but two-thirds of Israelis would support military action if coordinated with the United States. Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, veteran CIA operations officer, who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. Now, something quite interesting happened recently, Robert Baer. You mentioned Netanyahu involved in U.S. domestic politics, not to mention this election year. The New York Times recently ran an extensive article outlining a long and enduring friendship that Netanyahu has had with Romney, going back to their early days when they both graduated, one from MIT and one from Harvard, joined the same firm together as venture capitalists, and were the two rising stars in the class, and have forged a long friendship. This New York Times article prompted Israel's ambassador Michael Oren to New York Times print a rebuttal, where Ambassador Oren insisted that Israel does not interfere in U.S. elections. But this charge was not even made in the New York Times article, so that shows you a certain sensitivity. My sense is that is an absurdity, that if you understand the role of Sheldon Adelson, he has a newspaper and a television, Fox-like television network in Israel. His newspaper is free giveaway newspaper, entirely devoted to promoting Netanyahu. And Adelson single-handedly kept Gingrich in the race to split the anti-Romney ticket. So to my mind, and is that Gingrich has been a useful idiot for Adelson, and you can't help feeling that Netanyahu's fingerprints are there, and sure, they have been influencing the American election.
Well, you know, I mean, I think, you know, the Jewish Americans don't want to be accused of hijacking American foreign policy. But the fact is, it is hijackable. I mean, let's go back to the Iraqi invasion. It wasn't the Israelis that hijacked us into this war in Iraq. It was Iraqi exiles like Ahmad Chalabi. So, yes, American foreign policy is for sale, and it depends on the issue, how sensitive it is. And, you know, I don't think, you know, I mean, there's most Israelis, as you said, don't want an attack, and most American supporters of Israel probably don't want an attack. It's the crazies, but the crazies at the margin are able to hijack American policy. And I think the Israeli ambassador feels this sensitivity because he does not want this to look like an Israeli war. It's impossible to do, but I can see where the sensitivities are. And, you know, we have to be fair to Israel in the sense they're in a bad neighborhood. We've got to deal in the facts in this. You've got Egypt that's not going particularly well. You've got Syria. They may want to even get rid of the Bashar government, right? But they don't know what's coming next. And then you've got Lebanon with Hezbollah and all those rockets. And you know, every day they are facing questions of survival. So you can see the motivation, whether you agree with it or not, on Bibi's part.
Well, things are, and your point's well taken, but things are obviously changing rapidly. Right next door in Lebanon, for example, I don't normally quote Friedman, the New York Times reporter, who was one of the cheerleaders for the Iraq War, but he's been in Lebanon saying that Hezbollah is having a hard time now because of its support for the Assad clique, that both the Assads and Hezbollah have gotten their credentials based upon being the ones that confront Israel, and those credentials are now.
You know, absolutely right. I mean, Hezbollah rose. It was a popular movement. We can call it a terrorist movement if we like, but it's also a popular movement. And it had the support of most Lebanese. Now, all of a sudden, they're supporting, you know, massacring people in the streets of Syria. So much for their revolutionary credentials. And by the way, this is a key point of American foreign policy, is telling the Israelis, look, don't bomb. Watch what's going to happen in Damascus. Watch what's going to happen with Hezbollah. We can undermine both Bashar and Hezbollah, and you can still get your way without a war. Of course, the jury is out on what's going to happen in Syria, but there is a certain point to that. But on the other hand, it's, you know, what scares me is with declining Iranian influence, even with the Palestinians, or that they've taken a back seat to the Arab Spring, they become something more of a dangerous force in the Middle East, less responsible, and they're worried about their own future. And then you add that to the sanction on oils, it's getting cut way back, and you've got a popular movement there, and they have an incentive almost, the regime, and I'm talking about Ayatollah Khamenei, to provoke an attack in a sense. You know, what do they care if a couple of their nuclear facilities are blown up? I mean, it would be an enormous surge of support for the regime, or they would be given the justification to crack down on the dissidents in Iran. And this is the kind of logic of war in the Middle East that you really got to watch. It may not seem rational, but we're not that far away.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Behrer, veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the growing dissent in China. And he hears his master's voice. He hears the call to war, the sirens singing. You're only gonna hear what you wanna hear. Do you hear your master's voice now? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Perry Link, the Chancellorial Chair Professor for Innovative Teaching, Comparative Literature, and Foreign Languages in the College of Humanities, Arts, and Social Sciences at the University of California, Riverside. He's also Emeritus Professor of East Asian Studies at Princeton University and one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people. And he's translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. In the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protest in June of 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. Welcome to Background Briefing, Perry Link.
Good morning, Ian. Nice to talk to you.
And Perry, the Chen Guangcheng's escape subsequent—I mean, it's not being confirmed by the U.S. government that he's holed up in the U.S. embassy, but that seems to be the case. I imagine this is a humiliation for China's police state and an embarrassment for the leadership on the eve of Secretary of State Clinton's visit.
Of course, it's an embarrassment, and doubly so because it's right on the heels of this other problem they've had with Bo Xilai, who was an up-and-coming crypto-Maoist sort of star in the firmament of Chinese politics, who suddenly has been accused of corruption, and his wife of a murder of a British citizen, and his fall, and so on. So it's a sort of a double whammy, these two events coming together. I don't think the people who helped Chen Guangcheng planned it to coincide either with the Bo Xilai debacle or with the Hillary Clinton visit. But as it happens, these things do come together. And yes, it's a big problem of faith, as we say in Chinese culture, for the negotiations that are supposed to happen.
But there is a precedent going back to Tiananmen, isn't there, with Fang Lishai, who fled to the U.S. mission in Beijing after the Tiananmen massacre. And he was there for about a year, and that enraged Chinese officials.
Yes, and I was the one who brought him to the embassy and audited the 4 hours of negotiations between the two top diplomats in the embassy and him over the pros and cons of whether to stay or not. And the issues then were actually quite similar. The diplomats made it clear that he could stay if he wanted, but that it would allow the Chinese government to tar him and the whole student movement as being mere puppets of the U.S. administration, which wasn't true, and of course he wouldn't want. And also they warned him clearly that they wouldn't know when he could get out. They cited a case of some nuns in Romania who had come to the U.S. Embassy and gotten stuck for 14 years. As it turns out, Fang and his wife were stuck for 13 months, but that too is a consideration. On the other hand, to turn them out was dangerous for the U.S. side, because if it were known, and it would be known because I was with them for one, and also the room we were speaking in, they told us was bugged so that nothing we were saying was secret. So it would be known that they had been turned out, and if he had been turned out and then sentenced to a long prison term or even executed, then it would be terrible press. So I'm sure that the U.S. State Department now has that in mind, too, especially in election year. Do you want to have it on your record that you allowed this courageous rights lawyer, this man is really an impressive man, be sacrificed? They don't want to do that. So it's a really tough problem for the administration to figure out what to do.
Well, little wonder the Chinese authorities have blacklisted you, Perry Ling. Not only did you edit the Tiananmen Papers leaked by a high-level Chinese official, you took the leading dissident.
I was blacklisted before the Tiananmen Papers.
Right.
So they've never told me why I've been blacklisted,
right.
But it's more likely because of my helping Fang Lijie in 89, yes.
So, but they're clearly that's a president, and the difference, I suppose, now with Chen Guangcheng's being in the U.S. embassy, which is the assumption, he doesn't want to come to the United States, does he? I mean, he wants to stay in China.
No.
Yeah,
he doesn't. He's following the precedent here of Liu Xiaobo, the courageous Nobel Prize winner who is in prison now, and Liu made it clear, too, from the beginning that he would not accept exile. The Chinese government has figured out in the last two decades, really, that it's smarter from their point of view to exile these dissidents than to imprison them, because when they go abroad, they lose their credibility, they decline, and they're not so noticed. But if you're a Nobel Prize winner in prison or a blind lawyer who's saying, I want to stay in China and continue working for people's rights in China, you're much more of a thorn in the side of the regime. So I think, I don't know Chen Guangcheng. I met him in the mid-90s. I haven't seen him since then. I can't say for sure that he's as firm in that position that he will not accept exile as Liu Xiaobo was, but so far it looks that way. He said through his friends that he doesn't want to leave China.
So again, I'm speaking with Perry Link, who is a professor emeritus of East Asian Studies at Princeton University. He's edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official. And in 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. We're talking about dissent in China very publicly with this latest defection. This dissident was under constant house arrest. The movie actor Christian Bale tried to visit him some time back and was turned away by the secret police, or not-so-secret police.
He was in house arrest by the local authorities in his county in Shandong. That's something different from the central-level secret police.
Yeah.
My speculation is that the top in China are probably embarrassed at the way he has been treated down in Shandong, but they don't want to get involved in these local power holders holding the lids on their local areas, because the center and the provinces have a sort of understanding that we will let you do your thing in your area as long as you keep the lid on, and that's what the center wants. So part of Chen Guangcheng's fleeing from Shandong up to Beijing is not just to go to the U.S. Embassy, but to get out of Shandong. It is conceivable that the authorities in Beijing might take his side, as it were, and say Shandong treated you improperly. I don't think that will happen, but it certainly could happen, because the authorities that were really after him and were mistreating him and beating his family and so on were the local ones in Shandong, not the central ones in Beijing.
But that leads us, surely, Perry Link, to what's happening here in terms of the face of dissent in China, the growing dissent in China. Much of it's happening at the rural and local level, and it doesn't involve students and intellectuals like Tiananmen Square did. But these are farmers and local merchants who are sick and tired of being mistreated by the local party, Communist Party mafia heads. And I take it, you know, that this is happening all across China, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's the big difference from 20 years ago, when the student movement really was young intellectuals and students. And the term human rights in the 1980s was so politically sensitive that people didn't use it in public very much. But by now, 23 years later, the term rights, chuan in Chinese, has really seeped down, and ordinary people, including farmers, use that and say, we're supporting our rights, we're demanding our rights. So that the percolation now is much more from the very bottom up than it was 20 years ago. And the main puzzle for so-called dissidents, the people like Chen Guangcheng and so on, is how to take their sophisticated understanding of politics and law and hook it up with this vast undercurrent of dissent that bubbles at the bottom. Most people at the bottom have complaints about the level of leadership right over their heads, the ones that are picking on them. And they have this idea, more or less, that if we could get to the top, then the top would take our side. And they petition. They go to Beijing, and they go to provincial capitals to petition, and they don't get anywhere. What they don't see at the bottom is that the top is just as bad, just as mafia-like as the bottom. And it's the challenge to people like Chen Guangcheng to try to get the rights consciousness that they understand in a more sophisticated way articulated well with the discontent that's percolating everywhere.
Well, nothing, I think, exemplifies the notion of the mafia at the top and corruption at the top than the recent scandals coming out of the murder of a British businessman who was a kind of bag man or a business cutout for this wealthy family. And, of course, he was in the Politburo and he has tremendously, grand revolutionary credentials, doesn't he? His father was
really scandalous part there, too, was that he had been wiretapping the very top leadership. Hmm. Hu Jintao, the top leader, was wiretapped by this Bo Xilai guy. Now, I can't say for sure, but I don't think that's unusual. I think those top leaders do wiretap each other. In fact, they also record themselves. This is an interesting way to look at it. Top leaders, we learned this when we edited the Tiananmen papers, actually record themselves sort of the way Nixon did when he recorded his White House talks in order to have their own record of what the other person said and what they said. So this is not unusual. The top does treat itself that each other that way. They don't trust each other. It is more or less like a mafia culture. And this is exposed when the Bo Xilai affair comes along.
But his father was close to Mao, right?
Pardon?
Bo Xilai's father was close to Mao.
Bo Yibo, his father, was one of the party elders in the 1970s and 80s. He outlived Mao, but he was an original revolutionary.
So this gave this guy a lot of credibility with the party, but he sounds like he was as corrupt as anybody.
Oh, yeah, sure. And then the leader apparent who's coming in next year, Xi Jinping, is another son of an original revolutionary leader, too. These people are called the Princeling Group,
right,
because they inherit the mantle of revolutionary credentials, although by now they've completely abandoned the original ideals of the revolution and are in it for money and power now.
Right, and the corruption is so extraordinary that you've got them all wiretapping each other. It makes you wonder, there must be all these different sort of divisions within the police apparatus with divided loyalties, etc. This doesn't sound like a system that can last for too long, particularly with sunlight being an antiseptic.
Yes, I think so. It's hard to predict when, but I have the feeling, too, that we're at the end of a dynasty here.
and there's nothing a communist government fears more than a workers' revolt.
Of course, right. Ideologically, that's anathema, but in a more practical sense, it's just a constant struggle to keep the lid on. The budget for domestic spending on what's called stability maintenance a couple of years ago in 2010 exceeded the budget for the military that's supposed to handle external threats. So that fact itself tells you where the top leadership feels that its biggest threats come from. It's from their own people, not from the outside.
But you were just in closing, Perry Link, you were saying earlier that the real dissent in China comes at the local level from peasants, farmers, small merchants who are oppressed by the local Communist Party mafia.
Right, and laid off workers too, and yeah. Workers whose pensions have disappeared because in the work unit system in the Mao era and even the 80s, the post-Mao era, first decade, before the inflation got so bad, you could rely on a pension being something that you could live on. But now, those pensions stay the same size while the economy booms and all of this whole generation of elderly people that worked their whole lives honestly through the work unit system of the Mao era have nothing to live on. That's a source of discontent as well.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Perry Link.
My pleasure.
Again, Perry Link is a professor emeritus of Asian Studies at Princeton University. He's one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people. He translated many Chinese writings and poems, and in the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform students' protests in June of 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link, and as he just mentioned, he was the person who brought the famous Chinese dissident from Tiananmen to the U.S. Embassy, where he was holed up for a year. Little wonder he's been blacklisted. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking with the author, Robert Draper, of the new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do.
Behind the scenes, they grow their schemes, hiding
day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still, but nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool, and he never gives an answer, but the fool.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Draper, a contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine and National Geographic, and a correspondent for GQ. He is the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. His new book, just out, is Do Not Ask What Good We Do, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Draper.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And clearly your book is getting a lot of attention, breaking news, and the one piece of that's got most people's attention, and certainly mine, is that on the very day of the inauguration of President Barack Obama, which was an inspiring moment with 1.8 million people flocking in the mall on this bitterly cold day to celebrate this extraordinary event, later that day on that evening, Newt Gingrich and others got together, including Eric Cantor, a very prominent member of the House leadership, to plot the downfall of the Obama administration, literally talk about strangling in its cradle. And believe it or not, much of what they have plotted has come to pass.
Well, it's just to be clear, Ian, it wasn't intended to be like some dark conspiracy. It was basically 15 leading Republicans who are getting together to drown their sorrows because it had been a very depressing day for them. And so it was more just a, you know, kind of crying on each other's shoulders, at least conceptually. But in the course of their discussion at this place called the Caucus Room, which is a famous Washington steakhouse, they began, first of all, to elaborate on what had gone wrong, why Republicans had lost their way. And in the course of it, then began to discuss how they would dig themselves out of this hole. And what they concluded was that they needed to show unity, that they could not attack this very popular president, at least at that point, on a personal level, but that they should attack all, his agenda, and to do so unanimously if possible, to attack all vulnerable Democrats, and to use this as a pathway to 2010, when they would then hopefully win the House of Representatives, and thereafter use the House as the point of the spear against the Obama administration. And you're correct that that indeed has come to pass.
So what is the of course, the fact of the matter is that Congress is at an abysmally low 9% approval rating. And in many ways, one wonders who these 9% are, prompting the veteran House member from Detroit to say, what is it we're about?
John Dingell. John Dingell. I think even pedophiles could do better.
So, but what's interesting about your book is not just that it talks about this insurgency with the 87 House freshmen, the so-called Tea Party caucus, but also it chronicles what went wrong in a way when the Democrats had the trifecta. I'm always astounded that of the historical analogies here, that, you know, when Bill Clinton was elected, he had the trifecta. The Democrats had the trifecta. Right. They had the presidency, the House, and the Senate. 2 years later, a revolution took place, and the House, was taken over by Newt Gingrich. In many ways, I think the American people are very pragmatic. You know, whenever one party gets all three branches of the government, they expect something to get done. And in the first 2 years of Clinton, not for any fault of his own, largely he got more trouble from his own caucus than he did from the Republicans. He had that 94 rebellion blow up in his face, and then the same thing happened this time.
Sure, I think it's a pretty apt analogy, but where I think those two presidencies diverge is that Barack Obama took office as the economy was going south. Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, had been licking her chops, waiting for a Democratic president. She said that when George W. Bush finally left the Oval Office after 8 years, that it was like a big boulder had been lifted from her shoulders. What she meant by this was that at last she would be able to pass a sweeping progressive agenda. However, by the time Barack Obama was sworn in as president, I don't think that many Americans had an appetite for a sweeping progressive agenda. What they wanted more than anything else was for this new untried president to heal an ailing economy. And so when first the Democrats passed a $780 billion stimulus plan, and then followed it up with a cap-and-trade bill that did not seem to bear any relationship to the economic times, and then followed that up with a sweeping health care bit of legislation, they essentially walked into the narrative that the Republicans that night of January 20th, 2009 were just hoping that the Democrats would walk into a kind of quagmire in which they could allow Republicans to say, look, the Democrats aren't interested in joblessness. They're not interested in helping out struggling Americans. They're only interested in passing their big government agenda. And I think that's that was the story that that laid the predicate for the Republican takeover in November 2010.
And Robert Draper, that was the moment when the left lost the narrative that the right wing picked up, the far right wing in the form of the Tea Party, the public outrage against what happened on Wall Street and the bailout. And that was that vacuum was filled by the Tea Party. And I've always been astounded why the Democrats and the political left in this country were asleep. And they only woke up with the Occupy movement years later.
Sure. No, and in fact, you know, I write in the book about how in August of 2009, the aforementioned John Dingell, who is 85 years old, has served in the House for 57 years, longer than anyone in the history of that institution, faced one of the first very vitriolic town halls relating to Obamacare. And, you know, the people were literally screaming in his face. And though Mr. Dingell is quite adept at answering questions relating to health care, he hardly knew what to do with such an emotional response. And after two such town halls, told his staff there wasn't any point doing this anymore. At that point, the Democratic narrative really did get slip away from itself. And in 2010, Democrats, even the moderate Blue Dog Democrats who were often opposed to the Nancy Pelosi agenda, found attack ads in their district with their faces up against or adjoining an image of Nancy Pelosi as if the two were evil twins. And this, I think more than anything else, is why these 87 freshmen were elected on this Tea Party wave and allowed John Boehner to become Speaker in January 2011.
Again, I'm speaking of Robert Draper, the author of the new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. And it's just hard to understand, though, why that was a fleeting moment in time the stimulus wasn't big enough. Why the president thought the Republicans would cooperate with him? Nancy Pelosi apparently tried to tell him otherwise. I've spoken to Robert Putnam up at Harvard, who knew Obama when he was there, and said Obama would love these weekend seminars they'd have, the Sequoia seminars, where you know Ralph Reed would be sitting down next to a union organizer, and Obama would be mediating and this kind of stuff. It seems that he is that kind of person, but this has been so brutally partisan, and much of it's to do with what happened with this 87 freshmen, right? They simply don't want to take any prisoners. They don't believe in compromise.
Well, maybe further to the point, Ian, they earnestly believed that they were elected and given a mandate by the public to roll back the Obama administration. Now, this is not uncommon. We've seen a number of waves in the House of Representatives. I mean, beginning with after the corrupt Grant administration, when I think something like 80 or so Democratic freshmen were brought in, and when FDR came in 1932, beating Herbert Hoover, he was accompanied by 131 Democratic freshmen. And in each case, this goes on and on through, you know, Watergate, the Newt Gingrich Revolution, the Pelosi takeover in 2006. And in each case, they perhaps overinterpret or exaggerate the mandate that they believe the people have given them to enact sweeping change, when, in my suspicion, what the public is really saying is not so fast, slow down. Instead, what happens is that the public gets whipsawed then with the House attempting a 180-degree reversal of what the previous House had done. And that's what we began to see in 2011, where the House Republicans, very much, I think, you know, controlled more by these 87 Tea Party freshmen than by Speaker Boehner, began to aggressively attempt to roll back not only all Obama initiatives, but basically any Democratic initiatives over the last several years, and certainly that would include spending.
But there's something different about the Tea Party people in the sense that they don't, you know, they don't believe in compromise and consensus, and you have this situation now where essentially the total gridlock, and I don't understand why the public don't recognize that you don't hire these people to do your political work if they are this inflexible, and that they might as well be just, you know, what's the difference between them and Tea Party protesters on the street?
I mean, it's, right. Well, I think you're right, Ian. That in fact, I remember in the book chronicles this going to see a town hall of Corpus Christi, Texas Tea Party freshman Blake Farenthold, in which, you know, he laments in front of his audience that, you know, it's a divided government and there's really not much you can do but compromise. And then people in the audience stand up and start yelling at him and say, we didn't send you to Washington to compromise. You know, and on the one hand, I suppose you can respect the fact that they have a belief system, that they believe that they are there essentially on a mission that the public has sent them to drastically reduce government spending. On the other hand, anyone with a pair of eyes can see that the guys in the Senate who are in control are Democrats. The man sitting in the White House is a Democrat, and you're simply not, for example, going to get the Ryan budget passed with its Medicare entitlement reforms, with massive tax cuts, with massive cuts in government spending, and expect Democrats to go along. It just won't happen. And so, yes, that's the recipe for paralysis as we've seen it over the last year and a half.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Draper, the author of the new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives, a title, of course, coming from a 200-year-old cautionary tale lamented by Fisher Ames, in many ways the father of the First Amendment to the Constitution, talking about the House of Representatives that he was leaving in disgust. This is in disgust towards its zero-sum machinations. What I like about the book, though, and much of the publicity is about Eric Cantor and his guerrilla war to undermine Boehner. This Cantor, of course, being at that original meeting on the day of Obama's inauguration.
And Boehner, by the way, not being at that.
And then, right, and Cantor just seems to be a kind of a ruthless and determined player. And I think Boehner is still of that old school, but you know, he compromises a dirty word now. So I don't see his chances of surviving that looking that good. But again, you focus a lot on the Democratic side and what many feel is, you know, that wish they would have gotten more done, not wasted all their time on cap and trade and these and this tortured health care bill. A great anecdote in the book about Anthony Weiner, the disgraced congressman. This before, of course, he was taking pictures of his crotch and putting them on the internet. He was flying in Air Force One, and he went on to argue for the single payer system with President Obama. And Obama says, "Well, I don't have the votes for that." And then Anthony Weiner countered, "Mr. President, you only have votes for something when you go out and fight for them." And then Obama half-jokingly concluded the conversation by saying, "Well, enjoy your last ride on Air Force One."
What? No, and of course, there are a couple of ways to look at that conversation and about the Democratic legislative agenda in 2009 and 2010 writ large. And on the one hand, and it's been pointed out, I believe someone from the New York Times wrote an op-ed in response to that anecdote as I printed a couple of days ago, you could make the argument, as this columnist did, that that Weiner had it right, that President Obama could have and should have fought for a single-payer system. And in a lot of ways, you even see conservatives saying it would have been a more intellectually honest approach to universal health care. On the other hand, there were some strategic errors, I think, that the Democrats committed in 2009 and 2010, which, again, laid a path for the Republicans to take over. One of them was, as you mentioned, Ian, you can make an argument about the stimulus having been too small. What Pelosi and others told the president was that the votes just weren't there for a bigger stimulus. But what you could certainly make an argument for, and many blue dog Democrats did to Speaker Pelosi, was let's not, after the stimulus, then lead with cap and trade legislation. Most people don't understand why we're doing this in such an economic climate. Healthcare is a heavy lift. Let's do that now. If we actually have to muster so much energy for a cap and trade bill that is certain to fail in the Senate, and then try to go for a healthcare bill, we're going to find that we've lost a lot of momentum, a lot of our narrative, and a lot of votes. And that's unfortunately precisely what did take place. And it dragged a healthcare debate on for such a period of time that the Democrats sort of lost all coherence. And by the end of it all, famously couldn't explain the bill to the extent that Nancy Pelosi said, "We'll have to pass the bill to see what's in it." And that, of course, has been one of the most memorable taglines of the 111th Congress.
And, of course, Nancy Pelosi, who was pushing cap and trade probably because of support from the environmental lobby, she then gets reelected, even though I think her leadership was pretty disastrous.
Well, and the reason she was reelected is because there really was no one else among the House Democrats who had her fundraising clout. If you presuppose that the way to get back is to, you know, raise a ton of money so that you can recruit new candidates and so you can run a slew of attack ads across the nation, then Nancy Pelosi is the person to raise that money. But as a lot of, again, recently defeated Blue Dog Democrats said to Nancy Pelosi's face at a Democratic caucus shortly after the midterms, this is something that's written about in detail in the book, they told her, you're the face of defeat. And as long as the opposition can put up your face in an attack ad next to whatever candidate we're running, it hardly matters what that candidate's virtues are. People will just see Nancy Pelosi, and they will vote against that person, and which also, of course, is why there was a banner on the Republican National Committee headquarters that said, fire Pelosi, throughout the 2010 cycle. And then right after the 2010 cycle, they replaced that banner with hire Pelosi, because she's the gift that keeps on giving for the Republicans.
Well, Robin Draper, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives.
Thanks very much for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robin Draper, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and National Geographic, and he's also a correspondent for GQ. He's the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. His new book just out is Do Not Ask What Good We Do, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with former CIA officer Robert Baer, who George Clooney played in the movie Syriana. We're talking to him about a year ago. We spoke to him about the former head of Israel's Mossad going public and warning that Netanyahu was losing it and wanted to attack Iran. We were talking about how the head of Shin Bet, the equivalent of the FBI, just has gone public and saying, I do not believe in a leadership that makes decisions based on messianic feelings. I have seen Netanyahu and Barak up close. They are not messiahs, these two, and they are not the people I personally trust to lead Israel into such an event. Very outspoken. Clearly there's something going on in Israel that's alarming its intelligence and political and military leaders. So we talked about that, and it's an irony, of course, that in a moment when Hezbollah is in so much trouble inside Lebanon for supporting the Assad regime, who are murdering their own people in this and the broader proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran that's going on in the region, it would seem that Iran is very much on the defensive, not to mention the enormous squeeze from the sanctions that the Israeli leadership. Bob Baer doesn't believe they are bluffing. He thinks they're actually crazy, which is quite alarming. And then we spoke with Perry Link, who's been blacklisted from China. Now I understand why he was blacklisted. He's the guy that took the leading dissident from the Tiananmen Square to the U.S. Embassy, where he was holed up for a whole year. And a history now is repeating itself, where a prominent Chinese dissident is now apparently holed up in the U.S. Embassy. And this is all happening on the eve of Secretary of State Clinton's visit to meet with the Chinese leadership, who have just recently been embarrassed by this wiretapping by one of their members of the Politburo. Apparently they all wiretap each other. It's the whole thing, Chinese Politburo is akin to the mafia. Finally, I spoke with Robert Draper. His new book is creating quite a stir, Do Not Ask What Good We Do, about how the Republicans plotted on the very day of Obama's inauguration to do him in. And a lot of their plans seem to be coming true. But the book really does explain why the Democrats dropped the ball in the House so badly and in the White House in those first years of the Obama administration. And very, very much worth reading. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also get in touch with me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.